You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
It is Thursday, September 21st, 2017. My name is Michael Brooks on a Michael Thursday. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Jeff Stein of Vox joins us to talk about the next Republican effort, the current Republican effort to destroy the gains of Obamacare, destroy Medicaid, put your health in jeopardy, and why they're so exhausted that they can't even really lie about it anymore. Also, he went into the details of the Conyers single-payer proposal. It's ambitious, it's what America needs, and it has a record number of co-sponsors in the House. And, of course, Bernie's working his own single-payer proposal through the Senate. We will talk about the politics and policy of both. President Hassan Rouhani proving again that he is literally in every way Donald Trump's superior, responded to Trump's UN address and called for the world to continue to uphold its obligations on the Iran agreement, even as other heads of state and European negotiators acknowledge that Iran is in compliance with the deal. And Rex Tillerson tips his hand as the United States and the Trump administration start acknowledging that the reason to destroy the deal is not because of a lack of compliance, but because of other things that were never part of the deal to begin with. How does that affect a future deal with North Korea, which the president has threatened to destroy? Puerto Rico has been devastated by Maria. Massive power outages, serious devastation on an island obviously already deeply affected by austerity and the arrangement with the United States, which is neither a full state nor fully independent, obviously really a colonial territory. Mexico, the rush for searchers, for survivors, that disaster ongoing. And Sean Spicer never lied, knowingly lied.
He doesn't think he lied.
Doesn't think so.
I don't think so.
I don't think so. I don't think I just said I don't think so.
Did you cheat on me? I don't think so.
I don't think so. Or you could do a Cassidy. You promised to never cheat on me? Yep. Yep. Now, it's important, though, to keep our eye on everything. Today's show probably going to focus, obviously, primarily on the new war against healthcare, the new terrorism of the Republican leadership, and the disaster of destroying the Iran deal. Trump, credit where credit is due, he took some time at the UN General Assembly meeting this week to address the Africa delegation. The first piece of sound, we'll get to, you know, he made up a fake country, which isn't particularly surprising because his brain is like fried cookie dough. This initial clip where he talks about why his friends are going to Africa, I just wanted to highlight.
Africa has tremendous business potential. I have so many friends going to your countries trying to get rich. I congratulate you. They're spending a lot of money. But it does. It has a tremendous business potential and representing huge amounts of different markets. And for American firms, it's really become a place that they have to go, that they want to go.
have to go, that they want to go.
Those are the best kind of places.
Yes. The things that you have to do that you want to do are like totally the best things in a certain sense. I really, though, what I like about that clip, two things. One slightly tangential and one substantive, which I'll start with. When Trump clearly has no even beginning of a clue of what he's talking about. So right there, he's in like pure kind of genial kid who didn't do the work thing. You know, practically like maybe he does have enough exposure to like weird corrupt businessmen trying to like steal minerals or diamonds in Africa or something that he recognizes that it's a continent, not a country. But like I wouldn't be surprised if Donald Trump was an Africa's a country guy. And then when he does that in his unique verbiage, he basically just echoes most of – there's some programs, PEPFAR for AIDS funding and things like that. But the basically the attitude of Clinton through Bush and through Obama was let's make Africa a next hotbed for foreign direct investment and compete with China for contracts there. So there's been massive growth in Africa, but also – all the other things you'd expect, environmental devastation, austerity. That's why there's also, you know, a lesser covered but a kind of African awakenings movement, which protested things like a value-added tax on corn in Kenya. And Kenya is like one of those, you know, places that's held up as this great example. So it's funny when, in his own stupid way, he basically just says what the consensus is. And then I'm also wondering if the same head of state that Nikki Haley talked to that was so impressed by Rocket Man was standing there being like, where is the nickname for us? You come all the way here to tell us, well, I didn't know that you are investing. But until you say Africa is a great place or the investment continent. Actually, see, that's the problem. That could actually work. I call it the investment continent. I call it the Mr. Investment continent. Where are our nicknames? He did come up with a certain nickname of sorts in the next part of the speech, and this is what everybody's talking about, Trump declaring a new country.
In Guinea and Nigeria, you fought a horrifying Ebola outbreak. Namibia's health system is increasingly self-sufficient.
I mean, if Namibia is in your mind, it can be self-sufficient.
Namibia's got one of the best. We should really look to Namibia.
Namibia is a place that more and more people should look to. I would like that if there was like a imaginary African country that was the safe space in Trump's mind. Namibia is a friendly African country ruled by King Jaffe Jofer. The girls are black, but they're still tens, and they want to do deals with me. It's my safe space.
Do we know which country he was talking about? Was it Namibia?
Probably Namibia.
Or Gambia.
Or Gambia. Or Zambia.
I
bet he knows Gambia because the president of Gambia a couple years ago, several months ago, he literally flew off in a plane with like all of the – he's like, oh, yeah, I'll resign. No problem. And then basically literally personally stole almost like the entire state budget and flew out of the country. And I think Trump looks at that sometimes and he's just like, hashtag life goals.
The novelist Sinclair Lewis had a fictional state sort of in the upper Midwest called, it was Winnemac. Maybe that's what Trump is doing. He's like, I'm just going to combine those.
Just combining it.
Is Namibia.
I'm a big Sinclair Gambia, Lewis
Zambia,
fan.
Just, yeah, I'm going to Sinclair Lewis this.
Every joke about me that begins with the premise that I read a book is on very shaky ground. I'll give you just the real quick pitch. The Michael Brooks Show, we're at 636 patrons. It's essential, obviously, because, you know, paying salaries, paying rent, growing everything out. Just did two primers, Illicit Histories, the last couple, one with Bhaskar Sunkara on the hidden history of the 1917 Russian Revolution, then Mike Hanna, who was a CNN reporter and covered the Mandela election and the negotiations that led to the transition of apartheid. Those are the types of additional content that, as an example, Matt loves on the Michael Brooks Show.
Yep, I'm a fan.
Trying to give theory context and a way to sort of understand dynamics that are working in the world that definitely you're not getting anywhere else. And then there's, you know, the public show, which more and more people are giving great feedback to. You can always watch it at 7 p.m. Here on the Majority Report YouTube channel. Then the post game, it was really funny with Alona Miska, Alona. I'm going to get a mess her last name up, man.
Minkowski.
Alona Minkowski and I did a review of the Morgan Freeman ad for the committee to investigate Russia. And that was great. And then we're publishing original pieces of writing, people at higher levels I'm doing regular phone calls with. So please check it out. Really, really want to get as many people having the full experience as possible. Patreon.com/TMBS. Patreon.com/TMBS. We have no ads today, so we are going to take a quick break, and we will be right back with Jeff Stein of Vox. Back to the Majority Report. I'm Michael Brooks. Joining us now is Jeff Stein. I almost said Jeff Fox. Jeff Stein, congressional reporter for Vox. Jeff, how you doing?
I'm good. Thanks so much for having me, Mike.
It's my pleasure. We've talked about this a bit. Graham Cassidy is essentially the latest iteration of just a desperate effort to score a win on Obamacare in many respects. But it also, and I think it's getting lost a bit in some of the coverage because of how haphazard and dishonest and chaotic it is, it also fulfills a very long-standing Republican goal to seriously devastate Medicaid, not just the expansion that was won under Obamacare and the ACA, but also a broader effort to block grant it and not make it a just sort of, you know, a program whose finances reflect adjusting realities of people needing health care, but just a lump sum that states can administer. Maybe you could get us into the detail of, like, what does Graham Cassidy actually do? And a bit more, I think, on that Medicaid angle, because I it's at least as far as I read it, you would know better than me. That's the part of this that is, I mean, it's politically very risky, but it's also, I mean, this is a Republican generational goal to hurt Medicaid like this.
So let's get into, I think, a little bit later, like sort of the politics of how this works and how they're trying to sell it.
Sure.
Because I think that's sort of really important to harp in on. But just to sort of begin with your question about Medicaid, and I think this is why we had a piece on our website Vox today, sort of talking about why this is the most radical bill of them all. And I think the Medicaid cuts are really a huge part of that. Right now, Medicaid, as many of your listeners may know, sort of is like an open-ended commitment from the government to meet the needs of the people who qualify for it. So you are poor, you cannot afford health care, you're on disability, you can't afford to buy health insurance. The government we have decided as a society that we're going to protect those in need. And what this proposes to do, as several of the other Republican plans have in the past, is to say we're going to implement a sharp cap on Medicaid and tie the rate at which the government spends on Medicaid to the rate of medical inflation. And that really is a mechanism that Republicans see. And, you know, I've asked a number of them about this, and their answer is, look, this isn't a Medicaid cut because the amount of money in the program relative to now will continue to increase. And that's true, but it's still a sharp reduction in what the government, A, would be otherwise spending, and B, from what the government has historically promised poor people. So that's sort of a big part of it, taking a huge amount of money out of Medicaid from what would currently be the baseline. And then there's this whole other piece of it, which is redistributing the money currently allocated to people who buy private insurance on the Obamacare exchanges. And just to give you a quick summary of how that works, that's essentially saying, you know, we have this current system where the states that chose to go for the Medicaid expansion, we'll see their funding massively reduced, and a lot of that money will be redispersed to states that decided to not expand under Medicaid, and a lot of Republican states will stand to reap huge financial windfalls. So, like, those are the sort of main pieces of it. It's like dramatically reordering the Obamacare exchanges and the federal involvement in the Obamacare exchanges by giving red states way more money, by taking it away from blue states. And then the second piece is the dramatic Medicaid overhaul, which Republicans will say is not a cut, but really is a dramatic reduction in how much the government would otherwise spend. And I think a lot of people on Capitol Hill and a lot of liberals and critics of the bill view as a cut.
Yeah, I mean, and then there's also the, you know, could explain, I guess, also briefly why, and this is how Bill Cassidy, in some ways, you know, the kind of irony is if he had just not taken the opportunity to try to get some press for himself back in May and just sort of kept his mouth shut and been another sort of, you know, backbencher who does, in fact, have a medical background, he could have just been wheeled out, you know, to defend and sort of articulate what most people, you know, sort of objectively would sort of has been, you know, very questionable, if not absolutely dishonest defenses of all these versions of repeal. But he came out back in May and got himself in trouble because he put out this Jimmy Kimmel test thing and laid a marker down. He not only voted for skinny repeal, which of course would have destroyed protections for pre-existing conditions, but now is author of a bill that will do essentially the same thing. How is he defending that, and how exactly does this bill eliminate those protections?
It's really like probably the greatest mystery, and you really put your finger on it well at the heart of this whole thing. Yeah. Bill Cassidy, and I've interviewed him before, he staked out the most pro-coverage position almost of the entire Republican caucus. Like, he was running around telling every reporter he could find that Republicans cared about protecting pre-existing conditions. And then sort of out of nowhere, he became the lead advocate of proposing a bill that does the opposite. I mean, the bill itself, as I understand it, does not, as he sells it, and I think he's right about this, it does not necessitate that states strip protections for pre-existing conditions, but it creates opportunities for states to apply and grant and receive from the federal government waivers that would allow them to essentially say that, you know, the residents of their state do not have to honor these requirements. And this isn't like a hypothetical. It seems almost certain that, you know, Republicans control most state houses. It seems very likely that many Republicans would go forward with that plan. So I mean, the politics of this are like pretty clear that most Americans favor protections for pre-existing conditions. But like, if you add on top of that, that Cassidy himself said that he favored that and then is now proposing a bill that uncontestably at least opens the door to do that. I mean, he might have this sort of rhetorical sleight of hand that is defensible where he says, you know, we are okay with New York, California, blue states that want to keep these protections. But the real world consequences is that people with pre-existing conditions are more likely to be discriminated against. And then the other piece of this is like, if you, I mean, this is not on the pre-existing conditions front, but if you're, you know, they have marketed, and then maybe we can talk about the politics in a second, but they market this bill, Republican senators market this bill as a huge step forward for states' rights, for states' ability to administer their own health care. But that's really hard to do when the federal government is taking billions of dollars out of your state. It's very hard to say this is a states' rights bill when, in fact, the states have much less flexibility to oversee the system as they want.
Well, yeah, and also when there's a, and we'll get to this later when we go to the sort of, you know, maybe potentially countervailing force here, there's also, you know, the notion that I think it was Luther Strange trying to attach language to this that states couldn't opt to use this funding for to create state single-payer systems, which is, of course...
I think that was John Kennedy,
Oh, excuse
right?
me, John Kennedy, rather. Excuse
yeah,
me.
Yeah.
Pardon me, right. So, yeah, let's move to the politics of it.
Just to stay on that note, that may have been one of the most surreal exchanges I've had on the Hill, where they're advancing a proposal that they say the entire edifice for which is to give states the freedom to oversee their health care systems as they want.
Right.
And then someone is proposing, and I'm not sure it's going to end up in the final bill, but a senator says, well, we don't want them to be able to set up a single-payer system in their own state, even if they want to, which is just, it's so self-defeating of the entire purpose of the bill. And I think, I've just never seen so many reporters' jaws hit the floor in simultaneous unison as when a senator selling a bill for states' rights then says, also, we don't want liberal states to do what they want to do under this bill. I would also say that
it doesn't surprise me at all, I have to say. I mean, not even for a second. I mean, I guess being in New York, but I think that to me, I mean, it's just there's no debate, and this maybe does get us into the politics of it as well. And I do want to get to these exchanges because they're hilarious. Because one of the things, I mean, I'll set this up for you and then give you a couple of questions around it. But you went to the Senate and you got into the exchanges with, you know, Pat Roberts and Richard Shelby and Jim Inhofe and Ted Cruz. And I mean, you know, I honestly, even reading these out of like a full context, they're just utterly confusing in and of themselves. I mean, basically, these guys just seem like too exhausted and confused to even like effectively lie anymore. But I think that with regards to, you know, banning states from doing a single payer, I mean, obviously this bill is about, you know, upward level wealth redistribution. And I also suspect, and there are rumors that, you know, the calls are coming in from donors like the Koch brothers kind of being like, look, like, you know, you guys have not given us a big tax cut. You haven't repealed Obamacare. And you've done a couple of, you know, executive orders where you make us, you know, it's easier to pollute some streams or, you know, bribe some foreign countries or something. But this isn't what we paid for. You got to do something about this. So, I'm that's one part of the politics in terms of, I think, the pressure for them to go through this cycle again. And let me just attach a third, and you can take this in any order you want. But do you think that how a Murkowski or a Collins who actually opposed skinny on merits, the skinny repeal on the merits, I don't see how, other than a potential bribe, like in Murkowski's case, which you can maybe elaborate on, how they could flip on this. And even McCain, who, you know, I mean, it's just so bizarre to actually talk about, like, his personal relationship with Lindsey Graham like this, overriding the health needs of tens of millions of people. But, of course, you know, there it is. But his objection, again, has all been on procedure. This is even more constrained, limited procedure and lack of debate than Skinny repealed it.
Yeah, so a lot there.
Yeah, take it as you will.
I'll start with the, you know, you mentioned the story that I wrote, and you can check it out. The headline is, GOP senators are rushing to pass Graham-Cassidy. We asked nine to explain what it does. And it's sort of been like a strange phenomenon to watch the reaction to this story, because I have all of these other reporters and all of these sort of Twitter users and people online saying, wow, what a great job you did pressing these guys for, you know, asking them the tough questions and being critical and being a adversarial, dogged reporter. And that just, like, is so totally out of whack from how I see the job I did with this story. Really, like, all I asked was, what is the point of the bill? Like, how does it work? And that question, like, produced these bizarre answers that just we printed the transcripts out of, that, you know, in part, senators are incredibly used to answering process questions. Reporters like to ask, you know, when's the bill coming? How many votes do you have? How do you think this will play in the midterms? That a lot of them are just not used to talking about, like, the policy and how it affects Americans. And so it's just this weird thing where I just went around asking Republican senators, like, why is your bill good? And the reaction was like, wow, what a tough adversarial journalist you are.
Let me read what a part of this tough adversarial journalism right here. This is what Senator Pat Roberts, who, again, you know, even in this sort of, like, media cliche universe, like, this he's not even, you know, this is a veteran lawmaker. He's been in the Senate for at least a couple of terms. And this is you, Jeff. But why does this bill make things better for Americans? How does it help? Roberts, pardon me? Why does this make things better? What is this doing? Roberts, look, we're in the back seat of a convertible being driven by Thelma and Louise, and we're headed toward the canyon. That's a movie you've probably never seen. Jeff Stein, that's you. I do know Thelma and Louise, sir. Pat Roberts. So, you know, like, now it's like, oh, yeah, well, you get it. So we have to get out of the car, and you have to have a car to get into, and this is the only car there is. That's literally, I mean, that's verbatim.
You know, I listened to this transcript three times before publishing it, just to make sure, you know, 100% that we got it all right. Look, like, I maybe this is too generous, but I feel like I did a similar story where I asked Democrats, like, what do you want to do if the Republican bill fails? And they similarly have a lot of trouble answering these policy questions. They are given talking points by their staffs, and they run with them. And a lot of the times, you know, Pat Roberts is not a healthcare expert, and he's also not someone, even though he's a veteran senator, he doesn't focus on healthcare. It's not like he's not on the health committee, I don't believe. It's not his area of jurisdiction. And he's just used to spitting out political answers. And while this quote is hilarious, I think there's, like, a much broader, deeper question about, like, how much are we telling our lawmakers that what we prioritize in them is attention to the policy that they're implementing. I mean, there's been some great research and writing about how much time politicians spend doing constituent work and doing fundraising, and how little they really get to understand the policy that they're working on. But, you know, I think the other point here, and it's just so obvious, but it bears repeating, is, like, we're dealing with a sixth of the American economy and healthcare for tens of millions of people, and 28 million Americans are currently uninsured. Republicans are not waiting for a CBO score to tell us how many more people would be uninsured under the Graham-Cassidy bill, but it seems likely, and according to some of the outside analyses that have been done, that upwards of 10 million people at least would again lose their insurance. And these are people's lives. And to just view this from the perspective of the 28 midterms or Thelma and Louise is you know, I think we shouldn't lose our capacity to be shocked by that.
No, of course not. And I mean, even I I'm sure Ted Cruz, as an example, would fancy himself an expert on everything. And, you know, just you then he get, wasn't as, you know, funny as Thelma and Louise, or it wasn't as funny as Senator Kennedy telling you to read the bill, which I thought was a good flip there. But Ted Cruz basically, you know, states are the ones that adopt creative solutions. But even there, it's just the cliche of the sort of, I mean, I understand he might have, you know, been able to kind of spit something a bit more sort of effective. But anyways, what did you think? You thought Ted Cruz maybe a bit more?
I was just going to say a couple of the reporters on the Hill and I have been talking about doing a sort of drinking game for whenever you get a quote that is of a certain frequency. So
right.
Like the one I always hear is, we can walk and chew gum at the same time. So I think that should be like two shots.
Yes. Yes.
And then the other one is like giving states the power to do what they want should be another one. And the laboratories of democracy, maybe three shots.
Oh, laboratories of democracy, you should just take the whole bottle and just get it over with. I also like, it's like this bill is going
to... You're trying to kill me here, man.
I know. This bill is going to be like, there's going to be like a rider in it. It's like, oh, and by the way, in addition to blockading Medicaid, if a state wants to reinstitute slavery, they can. But no single payer. And the reason we got to get in this is because of a 90s movie.
It would be the Workplace Freedom Act.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. The work. See, you and I could be Republican political strategists, or senators, in fact. And I always have an answer.
Let's talk about the Cruz interview, because he really had the most coherent sort of like logical responses to my questions. Like they were responsive and they were related to what I had asked. And I think it's like really important to pay attention to what he's saying, because it's like the central thing Republicans will be arguing if this bill passes, or even right now.
Right.
And so like you ask them, right, like, what are you doing? Right. And they say, we're giving power to the states. And like, that's like fine. Like, I don't know if healthcare experts would be like that upset about giving states the power to have more control over their healthcare systems. But what needs to be asked after that is, if you're giving power to the states, why do you also need to reduce the spending that each state has by, you know, anywhere between $300 billion and $4 trillion over the next 20 years?
Right.
You see what I'm saying? Like, if you're
you're making the point that, as an example, you could theoretically argue, and maybe even not that theoretically, look, I'm the governor of, New York, or I'm the governor of Maine, or I'm the governor of Tennessee, and I know where certain community health clinics would be best placed or organized. I know people consume health in different ways. There's different types of health challenges and delivery, depending on the state. Give me some discretion, potentially, although this gets tricky because we don't want to undermine those standards. But yes, give me some discretion in terms of how I deliver it, is a totally separate conversation from and not contingent at all on just slashing spending on healthcare expenditure. And Ted Cruz is sliding those two things together as if they're part and parcel of the same process. I mean, theoretically, you could have a massive nationally funded generous system that ensured bare minimums, and then each state could do it in radically different ways.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And I think like it's not a stupid move on their part, right? Because like if you went to Paul Ryan and you were like, so what do you want to do to the American healthcare system? And he went around being like, well, we want to cut funding for Medicaid because we think poor people have too much money. Like,
right. Which is what they really think. Yeah. Right.
Which is what they're doing, right?
Right.
But like, you
right.
can't say that. It sounds crazy. So instead, you come up with this like this facade of we were devolving power to the states, and like there's a kernel of truth, and like the bill does take like a real attempt to devolve power to the states. But like, it's just neither here nor there to the question of whether Medicaid recipients have too much money. And I just think it's really important for like listeners to remember this, because in a few months, like, Republicans will be going around saying, like, you know, we passed a healthcare bill that was great at devolving power to the states. And it's like, it's just not the issue. It's just not the thing that's happening.
Right.
At least like not the principal thing.
So that, I mean, the way you're talking about it is disturbing to me. I mean, you think this is, I get, I mean, obviously there's momentum behind this, but as I say, I mean, and also, you know, Rand Paul, for what it's worth, I don't know what kind of pressure he'll get at the end of the day, but it would seem to me that if he's basically been staking, and he voted for the skinny repeal last time, but that was on a, you know, he had some procedural justification for it. But this version, I mean, in some ways, this bill, in certain respects, is what they sort of have made Obamacare out to be, you know, arguably. Mm. Like, I don't see any way that he, either from the perspective of actually in reality, he represents a state that has actually served particularly well so far by Obamacare. That's actually a practical political consideration. Then, of course, being this sort of far-right, you know, libertarian market faith guy, how that works. And Murkowski and Collins, I don't see how Murkowski or Collins or even McCain on the merits, how any of their particular, you know, issue sets are addressed by this. So, I mean, do you still think the three could be picked or no?
Said that,
yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I was sort of like among our Hill and healthcare reporters, I was the most bullish about the chances of them implementing BCRA or the skinny repeal back in July.
Yeah.
And I felt like that was actually pretty warranted. Like, you saw a ton of Senate Republicans do this sort of like very public hemming and hawing, where like Rob Portman would come out and say he was very concerned about Medicaid cuts. And then Dean Heller would say, you know, he's looking at the numbers for Nevada. And,
right.
And like a lot of those guys ended up voting for a bill that would have still cut, cut healthcare and cut insurance rates, like really dramatically, like millions of people losing coverage.
Yep.
And it was really only because McCain, came over at the last minute that changed. But I still really have a hard time imagining how they get this done. McCain would have to have a backflip of really like huge proportions. I mean, McCain's whole premise has been that we need to go through regular order and have sort of bipartisan hearings and have a markup process, and like how the Senate normally does business, instead of this like 50 vote threshold that, you know, middle of the night thing. And McConnell's clearly trying to appease him. They set up two hearings for the bill, although one was later canceled because the Republican who was trying to hold the hearing wanted to do it in the Homeland Security Committee. And everyone was like, hey, like, this is obviously a sham hearing. Like, we can see right through this.
Right.
So they canceled that one, but there's still going to be one more hearing. So there's like an attempt to placate McCain's concerns, but unless McCain is like really stupid, which I don't think he is, like, I think he'll see that his process complaints and his call for a bipartisan solution is still as salient as ever.
Maybe he's just even Brand's concerned. I mean, that's my read on McCain. I mean, he just, why would a guy, that's my only source of optimism, and maybe my cynicism is just shining through, but a guy like McCain, mm-hmm. who just is so, in many ways, I think, frankly, unjustifiably, but just this, you know, he is so attentive of his brand and his public image, and he got all these acolytes in exactly the way that he wants through what he did with Skinny. Why would he throw out all that goodwill and undermine the highlight reel? But, you know.
Yeah. It's hard to imagine, and yeah. It really is, like, if you step back and think of it, like, the reason that this is getting so much momentum now, or one of the reasons, at least, is that Lindsey Graham and John McCain are like friends.
Right.
So they were like, if we give Lindsey Graham and John McCain, if we put Lindsey Graham's name on the bill and like have him work on McCain, maybe that will be the big difference here.
Right.
And like the idea that the healthcare of millions and millions and millions of Americans depends on the personal friendship of these two,
like,
guys.
Two like old weirdos who've like plotted like a billion wars and like military jets and fact finding missions through the Middle East, and like, yeah, maybe Lindsey will bring him over. It's pretty terrifying.
That's the weird thing about the regular order,
yeah.
Deification that McCain has. It's like, well, you know, we're okay incinerating brown people in foreign countries as long as it's done through regular order, as long as it's like...
Well, actually, incinerating brown people in other countries could literally be called regular order.
I shouldn't laugh at that. It's too true.
Yeah. But so, and then Murkowski, Collins, and I mean, do you think Paul is a firm no on it or what?
Well, we have a healthcare reporter here, Dylan Scott, who, you know, I've sort of been going around saying that I think people are overestimating this is sort of a parlor game at this point, and obviously no one really knows. Paul had a press conference a couple of days ago at which he invited like 30 reporters and basically said, like, there's no way I could support this. Like, there's nothing they can do to change the bill. Like, it's so far from where I would ever be. Paul did vote for the skinny repeal, which would have left 14 million fewer Americans with insurance. So that is sort of like the reason that a lot of people are skeptical of
his
opposition.
But he has no problem with
that,
right? He doesn't care about that part of it.
Weeks before the skinny repeal vote, he said, I am okay with this idea. Mm. My favorite theory, even though like there's like not that much evidence for it, but there's this like sort of pet theory going around the Capitol that like Rand Paul has all of these ostensibly right-wing objections to a bill that would devastate Medicaid. But because Kentucky is a Medicaid expansion state, like it would also be horrible for his constituents. But he can't say like, I care about the welfare state because like he's a Republican and conservative. So the pet theory goes that like he is making up these right wing complaints so he can oppose a bill for left wing reasons.
It'll be like the first secret recording that makes somebody look human. Like it's like leaked to the press. Like, I just think it'd be really hard on like black people. And then it's like his supporters are like, get the fuck out. And he ruined his career by having a shred of human decency about coal miners and people in the inner cities in Kentucky getting decimated. No, I mean, I think that the thing with Paul's, I don't think it's an ethical concern, but I do think there's a very practical concern, which he could be hiding through, which is that, I mean, do you literally, and that's actually an interesting question with Mitch McConnell, because Mitch McConnell's built his whole career on, you know, advocating these sort of cuts and devastation on a national level, but actually being incredibly aggressive with getting every type of government funding and subsidy available to Kentucky, and kind of being like just the sort of machine public works guy almost in some ways in Kentucky. So it's actually odd, but, you know, on the other hand, he's almost done, and this will be his final, you know, gift to the Kochs before he goes and lobbies or whatever. On the other end, you actually did a really good treatment of the sort of the John Conyers bill. Has a record number of sponsors, co-sponsors in the House. John Conyers, of course, I mean, is a sort of just, you know, venerable progressive politician, very important figure. And you took a look at, you know, what it would actually do. And now, of course, we have, you know, Bernie coming forward in the Senate. I guess touch briefly on the Conyers bill, and are we setting up that even in the best case scenario, we kill Graham Cassidy, because that must happen. And I say that as someone who's obviously quite pro single payer, but you know, there's no doubt that this bill needs to be killed. It will harm a lot of people, but that, you know, they're going to keep trying, and you know, the Democratic Party seems to be kind of moving in a more coherent direction on this. So is this a preview of the war that we're going to have for the next, you know, foreseeable political future, an actual progressive national insurance plan, and then various
give a sort of an overview of the Conyers bill and the Sanders plan. The Conyers bill has sort of been reintroduced every few years, and it's almost like a napkin sketch is sort of like the right way to think about it. I think it's only 30 pages. The story I wrote about it was only like 200 words shorter than the actual bill text. And so what it really does is it's sort of just like, if progressives could imagine like their ideal healthcare system and just threw it all in there, like what would it look like? And that's sort of what the Conyers bill does. And the way this works is it says, instead of having, this complicated system where, you know, you have private, you know, 50% of Americans are on private health insurance through their employer. And if they lose a job, if they're unemployed, if they have to, if they get fired for some reason, then they're suddenly without care. You can go on Medicaid, but it takes time. It's, you know, very expensive. Even, you know, then even the public options and even the private options have significant cost sharing. So if you are a poorly paid worker, you can have deductibles and premiums that are a huge financial strain or put you into medical debt, even if you have insurance. That's not counting the 28 million people who don't have insurance. So we had this like crazy quote system. And the Conyers plan says, like, screw all that. Let's just have one single government insurer that covers everyone at no cost. Everyone can get as much health care as they want, and we'll pay for it by higher taxes on the middle and upper classes. And critics say that the middle class tax hikes required would be substantial, but in exchange for no health care spending the rest of your life is a pretty good counter offer to
you'll save
6 or 7% payroll tax increase.
No doubt. You'll save. Yeah.
The Conyers bill has like a bunch of other really interesting features that are just sort of like, wouldn't it be cool if we could do this? So it calls on eliminating all for-profit hospitals, for instance. It has these plans for states to run their own Medicare for All offices that would coordinate coverage in the entire state. It would sort of be like the death panels thing that Obama was demagogued for, but like not invented, like actually. They would have panels responsible for deciding like the allocation of medical resources in a way that would make it much more efficient. We spend, you know, more than any other country on healthcare by a factor of like 3 or 4, and get worse outcomes. So this is a way of taking private insurers, pharmaceutical companies, and saying we're going to do this in a rational way that improves people's care, reduces overall spending, and also guarantees that everyone can get insurance regardless of their income and status.
Yep.
This was like sort of the aspirational plan that has existed for years in this Conyers House plan. And Sanders, who obviously sort of catalyzed this huge movement, now has millions of followers, did very well in the Democratic primary, although obviously he lost. This single payer bill that Sanders reintroduced was an attempt to take like the existing single payer plans that had been introduced in Congress and say, like, how do we actually create that single payer system? What would that actually mean? Like, how would we actually go about doing that? We want to have every American off their existing plan and onto this one government run Medicare for All plan. How do we go about doing that? And Sanders' plan, the biggest innovation in it is it calls for a 4-year transition phase in where you'd first cover everyone up to 18 on this Medicare for All plan. And then everyone age 55 and older in the first year, the second year that age eligibility would be dropped down to 45 and then 35 until in the fourth year, everyone would have a Medicare card that would give them free insurance. So that was like the way in which I think a lot of Senate Democrats said, oh, I already stand for dropping the Medicare enrollment age from 65 to 55. Mm-hmm. Once you do that, then you say, oh, let's do another 10 years, another 10 years, another 10 years.
Right.
And in sort of a subtle way, Sanders scaled back like a little bit of the ambition and the immediacy and the radicalness of his single-payer bill in a way that allowed 17, basically a third of the Senate Democratic caucus, to get behind what was once this incredibly radical left-wing proposal, at least as it was regarded.
Yeah. So, I mean, and it seems like it is fitting. I mean, the structural impediment to Democrats really moving in a more firmly kind of progressive or left direction is, you know, the bottleneck in American politics is obviously just money and, you know, the sort of set of interests that are represented by money. So it's harder for for sort of parties to flow into natural categories. And Democrats are obviously also a more complicated coalition party as well, with a number of different kind of historical influences. But that said, I mean, and as a final question, I mean, healthcare being the kind of preeminent thing, that Medicare for All has sort of come as a stand-in, as a policy in and of itself, and then also broadly more reflective of, you know, are you going to think about, you know, monopoly issues in today's world? Are we going to have to start, when are we going to start having to think about breaking up Google and Amazon? And, you know, how serious are you about inequality and dealing with globalization? And that
the way you frame it is exactly the same as Sanders, actually.
Right.
I think that it's worth noting, and I interviewed him about this, about his bill, and I asked him, you know, like the wonks in the Democratic Party will say, blah, 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 blah. What do you think about it? And his reaction I thought was interesting. He said, direct quote, this is not really a healthcare debate.
Right.
He thinks this is about whether the public will get together to stand up to concentrated economic power.
That's right.
That the fundamental question is not how do you write a good single-payer bill. The fundamental question is, can the public will overcome the stranglehold of the 1% on the nation's capital? Sort of as you were suggesting, it's there's a belief out there, and I think it's for it that, you know, more than half of Americans think the government has a responsibility to pay for people's care. And public opinion shows that the pharmaceutical companies are extremely unpopular. And this varies depending on how you frame the questions. But depending on the tax increase, like most Americans are willing to pay a little bit more to make sure everyone has free universal care. And so he does not see this as a sort of wonkish policy debate. He says it sees it as a question of political power. Can we build the political power to transform the nation's economy? And I think that ties in really well with your like second question of like, you know, are Democrats going to be the party that takes on the trust that goes after Google and Amazon, that doesn't let sort of these massive consolidations that are really bad for prices and really bad for consumers. And I think Sanders believes that, you know, if we can, as he would put it, create the political revolution that did it. And this sounds like super airy and like kind of naive and idealistic, I think, sometimes. But like you really only have to go back to a few, like to 2008 to see what happens when you dramatically goose the number of people involved in the political process. Right. Obama's victory did transform the number of people in American politics, and as a result transformed the policy debate in Washington.
Just to add to that, you know, before we wrap, and you know, tell me what you think of this. There's a broader debate which I see as a very false one, pivoting sort of the struggle that Sanders is articulating, which is these sort of defining issues of the time, with also the other defining issues of social justice, social emancipation, and, you know, various categories, racism, sexism, and all of these things. And, you know, obviously, I think pretty clearly from my perspective, the Obama economic and sort of policy set was third way, was Clintonian, not nearly enough to the left, and in some ways with, you know, Silicon Valley, just a problem in and of itself. But that election, I don't think you'd have the backlash and the and just how, you know, the sort of obscenity of Trump and the grotesqueness of the sort of resurgent racism, but you also would not have this sort of reconfigured map of, you know, what had been speculated about of a genuine multicultural, multi-ethnic, multi-geographic coalition that could sustain, you know, some form of center-left or centrist to now hopefully actually progressive governance. That was demonstrated and exemplified by Obama, and the positive currents of those types of liberations and improvements are absolutely set in the context of him winning in 2008. So not only was that energy leveraged, I think sometimes on our side, we just go to the narrative where it was like, I should say like my side, not to speak for you, just that, you know, oh, well, all this great energy happened and then nothing really radical happened on Wall Street and healthcare and all the rest. I basically agree with that narrative, but I also think there's a whole other set of concerns and issues, representation and power, that actually was accelerated significantly by that win and you know, demonstrated the value of it.
I think that's definitely right. And if you look at sort of the main things that concerned people about Hillary Clinton, one of the biggest things, of course, was the Goldman speeches and the Wall Street speeches. And I don't know, I found like a lot of these debates over whether Trump's victory was due to economic anxiety in the populace or racism, to be sort of reductive.
Yes.
Obviously it's both, but to say that, that it is an incontestable force, that Trump's racism and the racist climate he tapped into were so powerful that nothing could be done to stop it with a more progressive and a more inclusive and a more robust economic message that didn't associate Democrats with plutocrats, is not only to me, it's not just, I don't think it's, I think it's wrong, but I don't understand, if you do think it's right, what the purpose of saying it is. Like, if you really believe that Democrats, you know, that there's nothing they could have done to be less associated with a plutocratic class, that because they were associated with a multicultural coalition and America is irredeemably racist, that Trump's victory was inevitable, then, like, what is the point of any of this? Like, if that is your perspective, like, what do you do?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Jeff Stein, I really appreciate your time. And,
it was wonderful being on.
Let's do it again. Jeff Stein, congressional reporter for Vox. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me. Take care.
Bye-bye. Okay, everybody. We're going to get to the fun half.
He's good at that.
He is good at that. It's a great conversation. We're going to talk about some of this Iran stuff. Jimmy Kimmel. At this point, we're just like, just pro Jimmy Kimmel.
It's been a bad year for Fox News.
Oh, God, it's been a bad year for Fox News.
I don't know. What happened to Brian Kilmeade on Jimmy Kimmel's show last night?
It's beautiful. In fact, I think we're going to start with a nice palate cleanser. We'll probably get straight to that in the fun half. MajorityReport.fm/become a member. Write a review on iTunes. JustCoffee.coop. You know the way this show survives. If you're Jewish, you're part of the tribe, as I half am. Happy New Year. Let's try to, be better, more compassionate. 646-257-3920.
Talking about Jews or everyone?
I was talking about everyone, but okay. I realized that might have sounded like a Jew-specific message, which is pretty funny. Jews, I have a message for you. If you look at Benjamin Netanyahu and you see his son tweeting...
Kekistan memes.
Like Kekistan anti-Semitic George Soros memes. I think it's... It's like one of those things when BB's son, and he actually did this. I'll just take, 30 seconds, do a fun half tease. This will take up some of our fun half time. So this is some of the stuff that you might get in the fun half freebies. When you see BB Netanyahu's son, I think it was Facebook. Was it either Facebook or Twitter? I don't know. He literally tweeted out a George Soros, like, controls the globe image with, like, Soros with, like, a big, you know, like, hook. No, I mean, and you look at someone like me who opposes the Israeli occupation and subjugation of Palestinians because I'm just a proponent of, like, you know, weird stuff like global human rights that applies to all people, regardless of their background, including Arabs, which I guess, you know, freaks some people out. But there was always a secondary argument, which is like, yeah, I actually do have concern about Jewish community and Jewish identity. And like running an apartheid state is really bad for the morale. And when you see the son of the PM do that, I don't want to spike the football here, but yeah.
The Holocaust was a long time ago. I am on an MRA forum, and the reason that we must put the white phosphorus on the Gazians is because the girls will not date us anymore because we think that a man should work outside of the house. And George Soros has funded them just like Black Lives Matter. My dad is the prime minister of the only Jewish democracy in the world.
I need to pull running an apartheid state is bad as a job.
Yeah. Dad. Bad for morale. All
the
right.
Decision.
Yeah. Not good. Apartheid, bad. See you in the fun half.
Looking back, she said, no, no, no.